point here, and it says that in the suttas all the time, you know, a son or a daughter from a good family goes forth, you know, the prince or something like that goes forth, because the Dhamma, everybody has suffering regardless of your status in life. So this is the point here. That's why the householder is mentioned specifically. And then one born in some other clan is just to say that it includes everybody. There's no exemption from this. So then, on hearing that Dhamma that the Buddha or the Tathagata expounds, you acquire faith in the Buddha, right? You hear the Dhamma, and on that basis you acquire faith. So is, first of all, what about this word faith? Is that really a good translation into English? The Pali word here is saddha, right? Saddha. And saddha in Pali is used in a couple of different ways, or rather it has a couple of different meanings to it. It means, first of all, the kind of intellectual confidence, right? You listen to something and say, yeah, this makes sense. Not really intellectual, but the sense of confidence that something makes sense, that something is trustworthy. Or you watch somebody and you see that their behavior is according to how they speak and according to how they act. Act is also, you know, speech and action are in conformity with each other. And that must give rise to confidence, right? So this is like reasoned confidence. And then there's also the heart factor, the confidence of the heart. That is a feeling, you know, the positive, good feeling that comes from having confidence. And this is what we're trying to develop when we do things like the recollection of the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha, is that confidence which gives a beautiful feeling inside. So there's these two aspects to saddha in Pali. There is like the feeling of kind of intellectual confidence on the one hand, and then the feeling of the feeling that comes with that when you really feel this is something powerful and beautiful, the happiness and joy that arises inside as a consequence. So I think that confidence is probably a preferable translation, because the word faith, it is used often in all kind of other religions, is often used in quite a different way from the way it is used in Buddhism. So I think, to me, confidence is a better way of translating this. So you acquire confidence in the Buddha, but we hear the Dhamma, I think, wow, there's something powerful going on here. And it's not just the hearing of the Dhamma, but it's also watching the Buddha. This is what I was talking about before, and the Buddha specifically says this in another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Vimamsaka Sutta. He says, you should watch me here, and you should see if you can actually see any states. Can you see anything in me which gives rise to the, you know, the feeling that I must have some kind of anger or greed or delusion. Can you see that in me? You should investigate me. Obviously, the Buddha is confident, right? You won't see these things in him. So he's happy to say that. So please investigate. And what that shows you is that that's what we also should be doing. We should investigate these things. And if there is reasons for doubt, you shouldn't be afraid of having doubt. This is actually part of the duty of anyone who is going on the spiritual path, to investigate and then have doubts if there are good grounds for having doubts. Not to be hypercritical in a kind of silly way, but look carefully here. So, when you hear that Dhamma, and you see that the Dhamma is congruent with the behavior, and the behavior is congruent with the Dhamma, these things go together, that is when you start to acquire that confidence in the Buddha. There's actually another interesting sutta as well, is also in the Majjhima Nikaya, and that is a householder or a layperson says to the Buddha, but you know, sometimes it's very hard for us to, there are these monastics around, it's very hard for us to really judge whether these monastics are pure or not. We are too far removed, right? We don't really see them close up enough to be able to know whether they have the qualities that they're supposed to have. And there is some truth to that. You know, you have to have a certain relationship with somebody to be able to judge these things. And the Buddha there says, quite interestingly, that the way to make a judgment in that sort of situation is to see how people live. And if people live contentedly, happily, you know, say in a forest somewhere, in a kuti, somewhere far away from society, not indulging in the ordinary pleasures of the world, then you can take it that they have something else. There's something more in their life that sustains them, that makes them able for them to live that kind of life over the long term. And then that is an orphan enough, he says. That is enough to show you that this is someone who, at the very least, they're practicing in the right way and moving in the right direction. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to live this kind of life, right? So this is the second way to judge, is just to see how people actually are living their life and where they're getting their sustenance and happiness from. So then, when you see that, you acquire confidence in the Tathagata. And then, of course, once he has that confidence, it says here, this doesn't always happen, but it happens sometimes, then you realize that you want to go forth. Why? Because household life is crowded and dusty. So I like this kind of idea, crowded and dusty. Basically, it means that when you live in the house, right, in the home, there's people around you all the time. Your family is there. I think in those days, it was probably much worse than it is now. And families were much more extended families, right, with servants and all these kind of things. These days, we have more the idea of the nuclear family, which is a bit smaller. But still, you know, when you live a life in a house, it still is, there is still this feeling of being more impinged upon by the people around you. And in contrast, he says here, the life gone forth is wide open. And I can relate to that. You know, when I think back what is life like to live with my family, and I tend to think about what it's like to living in the Kuti, there is this kind of sense of freedom. You feel a kind of sense of freedom just by sitting by yourself. There's nobody around you, nobody to impinge upon you. You have this sense of being removed, right? And there's a freedom in the mind that comes from this feeling of being removed. You feel a sense of liberation as if you are not impinged upon by what is going on around you. And it is quite, once you get used to it, it's actually a very pleasant and very nice feeling to have that sense of distance and room around you. And you get a little bit of feel for that here, although here is still quite close together. But when you stay in the Kuti somewhere, you really get that feeling of being separated, both physically, but especially mentally. You get this mental feeling of separation, which actually is very peaceful and nice feeling. Okay, so you decide you want to do it, give up the household life because it's crowded and dusty. The idea of dusty in the Pali language is raja. Raja is dust, and the idea of raja is a metaphor for defilements, especially for desires. That is what raja is all about. It's a metaphor for defilements. So once you what it's like, you live the home life, you're around people all the time, it's very easy for defilements to arise, right? It's easy to get irritated by something. A house is also a place where you enjoy yourself with entertainment and all kinds of things. It's easy for cravings and desires to arise. So defilements are much more likely to arise in that sort of setting than they are in the setting of a monastic life, where you are a little bit removed from all that. So that is what he thinks. And then he says, it is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life utterly perfect and pure as a polished shell. Again, perfect here should probably be complete, utterly complete. In other words, fulfilling all the factors of the path is much harder in a home life, he says here, than it is as a monastic, precisely because the home life tends to stir up the defilements and the attachments, etc., much more than the life gone forth. So then, because of that, he says, well, maybe I should shave off my hair and beard, right? Put on the yellow, perhaps not yellow, ochre or saffron robes, and go forth from the home life into the homelessness. You can see here how the suttas are often very kind of male-centered, right? Shaving off hair and beard. The reason for that is, of course, not, first of all, it's important to realize, it's not because this is only relevant for Buddhist monks or whatever. The reason why it is like this, and we can only really speculate, but one reason is obviously that the monk sangha was established before the nun sangha, right? The bhikkhus came first, the bhikkhunis came afterwards. There would have been a stock of suttas that already were circulating before the bhikkhunis even came into existence. So that is probably one reason. The other reason probably is that the Buddha would have given many more discourses to the monks than he gave to the nuns, because he was around the monks most of the time, for obvious reasons. That would have been another reason. A third reason would be that in the history of the transmission of the suttas, I think, I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think it's probably reasonable to guess that the transmission happened more through the Bhikkhu Sangha than the Bhikkhuni Sangha. And because the transmission happens through the Bhikkhu Sangha, it is more likely that they will use the word "it was said to a Bhikkhu" rather than "it was said to a Bhikkhuni" in reciting. Not because they necessarily wanted to bias, but simply because that was kind of the natural way to go if you are a Bhikkhu, natural way to think. And especially if the majority of suttas already were given to the bhikkhus, that was kind of the default, right? That was the main word that was used. So the rest of the suttas will tend to fall in line with the main ones. It is also possible, of course, that sometimes because it was bhikkhus, they just naturally said bhikkhus rather than bhikkhuni. And there may have been a kind of slight gender bias there. It's very hard to rule that out. But I think there are also many natural reasons why it has come down this way. And it's important to understand that, because once you understand that, you realize that these suttas are both for the male sangha, the female sangha, and also actually for lay people, right? These things are also for lay people. Even though it starts off with saying going forth, the reason why it starts with the going forth is because this is a gradual training that goes all the way to the end, right? All the way to full awakening. And to go all the way to full awakening, you need usually to go forth somewhere in that process. So this is also for lay people, but it's kind of, because it is a full training, that's why it is given to monastics in this way. I think sometimes I'm just saying these things just to kind of give you a little bit of broader idea of what is happening here in terms of the transmission of the suttas and these kind of things. There's lots of interesting things lots of interesting information that enriches your understanding of the suttas, historical information in this way. Okay, so then he decides. So he decides to shave off his hair and go forth into homelessness. So later, on a later occasion, abandoning a small or a large fortune, abandoning a small or a large circle of relatives, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. So, you abandon a small or a large fortune, right? You give up just trying to think of the Pali word for fortune here. What is the Pali word for fortune? I can't remember now. Anyway, you're giving up your possessions. That's basically what this means. And this is an important point, right? When you go forth into monastic life, the idea is to live a simple life. It's to give up all those worldly possessions. It's because you understand that they are a burden if you want to live the monastic life. That's what it's all about. And it's useful to remember that, because it is so easy as a monastic. You know, the problem with monasticism is that very often people go forth and become monastics for all kind of other reasons than to actually live the monastic life. It's useful to know that historically in many countries, and I'm talking about traditional Buddhist countries, that monks have had very clear, defined roles in society. They have been the teachers, they have been the doctors sometimes, right? And they have had a very clearly defined social role. And because of that, the idea of being a Buddhist monk to practice for awakening wasn't always at the forefront of the mind. In fact, it may not have been in the mind of some of these monastics at all, because they had more like a social position. And this is just what happens, right? This is not meant as a criticism of these monastics at all. It's just that this is what happens naturally over time. Things tend to go this way. And they still had an important function to play in society. But of course, once you move away from the ideal of practicing because you want to practice the path, then all kind of worldly considerations comes into play, right? Then suddenly a bit of wealth is kind of, why not have a bit of wealth if you're going to be a teacher or a doctor instead? You know, there's nothing wrong with having a bit of money, using money and all these kind of things. So it tends to corrupt the purity of the path once you move away from the actual ideal for which you really become a monastic. So it's important to remember that. And this is, you know, again, when you read the word of the Buddha here, it becomes very clear. You're supposed to give up your possessions, right? Give up your wealth. Bhoga. Bhoga is the Pali word. Bhoga kanda. And bhoga means possessions, basically. Any kind of possessions that you have. So you give up all the bhoga, all the possessions. And the idea is then not to accumulate possessions once you are a monastic, to keep it as simple as possible. And which sometimes is very hard. Sometimes things tend to accumulate, whether you want to or not, almost sometimes. So you have to be careful. And so keep that. It's good to keep that in mind as a monastic, that life is supposed to be simple and easy. It's very inspiring. Sometimes you see people, you know, like Ajahn Brahm, when he travels around the world, all he has is this little shoulder bag, right? He gets on the plane, he goes away for a couple of weeks, and all he has is a little shoulder bag. It's actually very inspiring. That's all he carries with him. Or you have Ajahn Sujato. He leaves the monastery. He goes to Sydney once a month. And every time he leaves Bodhinyana Monastery, he carries all his belongings with him. His shoulder bag is a little bit larger because you have to carry everything you own. But everything is there with him when he goes, right? What a wonderful thing that is, and how easy that is. It means you can go. You don't really have to come back. Nothing to look after, right? It's a great way of living your life. So anyway, it's not as important to remember these kind of high ideals, because they sort of put you on the straight path again. And then you abandon a small or large circle of relatives. This is what it means to kind of go into a forest monastery, right? You're going away. That doesn't mean that you can never visit your family again. Even in the suttas, there are examples of monks visiting the families. Ratapala Sutta is one such occasion. But it basically means that you're creating a bit more distance to your family. And that is not a bad thing. Sometimes people think that's a bad thing. But actually, there is less contact. But often the contact that you have with a child or with a brother or a son or daughter who has gone forth, there's more quality to that contact, right? There's less intensity, there's less of it, but the quality is much greater. And in the end, what really matters? Is it the quality of the contact, or is it the quantity of the contact that matters? And I think the quality is far more important. And that's why the Buddha always says that when you have someone in your family, like a son or a daughter who goes forth, he said there's a tremendous benefit for that family. Why? Because the quality of the contact suddenly increases so dramatically. Suddenly you can actually learn something from your family members rather than just hanging out and having a good time and enjoying yourself. Suddenly you can actually have a decent conversation about something, right? It was quite fascinating. Some years ago, my father said that to me. He said to me that, you know, I used to be your teacher, now you're my teacher. And I thought to myself, wow, that's a compliment coming from your father, right? It's kind of unheard of, but a beautiful thing. And it occurred to me, the power of being a monastic, there's something very powerful about that. And if you have parents or family members who are wise enough to understand that there's something beautiful there, they will be able to take some of those things on board precisely because you are a monastic and you are in that situation. So it is a wonderful thing. So it's important to think like that, because when you think like that, it doesn't become so painful when a family member decides to go forth and you start to understand that there's something very important and very useful happening when this happens. Okay, so you leave all of these things behind and then you go forth and into homelessness and you become a monastic. So that is the right intention on the path here, or at least it is one way of seeing right intention. And once the right intention comes into place, then you start to actually undertake the training, right? So this is the next part here. So now we are moving into the areas of right action and right speech. Again, you can see how it follows the Noble Eightfold Path here. Okay, so the first part here, this is about right action, first of all. It is interesting, in the Noble Eightfold Path, right speech comes first, then right action. In the gradual training, it's the other way around. Right action comes first, then right speech. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe there has been a... I'm not sure if that is on purpose or whether it is just an accident of some kind, or whether it is a mistake has been made. I don't really know. But I don't think it matters all that much. Anyway, so this is right action. This is how right action is described in the gradual training here. Having thus gone forth and possessing the bhikkhu's training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings with rod and weapon laid aside. Conscientious, merciful, he abides compassionate to all living beings. So there you can probably see there the idea of, this is very similar to the first precept, right? The first precept about not killing any living beings is very similar to that. And that the important point here, there is more here than the first precept. The first precept is very much focused on the negative side, on what you shouldn't be doing. You shouldn't be killing or killing animals. But here, it is focusing as well on the positive side of morality, right? And this is the first important point to understand about the gradual training in the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's something which perhaps is not talked about enough traditionally, is that the idea that morality has two aspects to it, two sides to it. Development of character has two sides to it. It is the avoidance of what is bad, but also the doing of what is good. So you avoid the killing, but not only that, you're actually conscientious. You are, it says here, conscientious. Lajji is the Pali word. Lajji means like you're not shameless, right? You are careful. You are conscientious, may not be a bad translation. You are merciful. Daya panno. Daya is like a word for daya, is like a word for compassion in the Pali language. He abides compassionate to all living beings. This is the word here is, I think it's karuna, I think is the word that is used here. I think so. I can't remember just off the top of my head. And of course, what this means is that this first precept is not just about not killing. It's also about not torturing, right? You can't get away, but I'm not going to kill, I'm just going to torture, or I'm going to kind of injure. All of these things are part of this precept. In fact, you are kind, you are gentle, you're doing all the right things. This is what this is really all about. So please keep that in mind when you living your daily life. Try not just to avoid the bad, try deliberately to do the good. And some days it feels natural to do good things because you feel good and it feels very easy to do what is nice. So please do so. Whenever you feel like doing something is nice, never waste the opportunity. Take that opportunity and do kind acts, do good things. And that will come back to you afterwards, a thousandfold, a millionfold, right? Both in terms of your meditation, also in terms of future karma and the results you get from that. Every time you do something good, it kind of boosts your accumulated goodness inside, and it will empower your meditation so much. So take every opportunity. Sometimes people think you may be a bit strange because you're doing all this, this random acts of kindness. But it's a wonderful thing, right? And we know that it has kind of a good effect on people around us. Sometimes you do an act of kindness to somebody, and I know in my life, sometimes I think back, somebody did something really nice to me, and I think, wow, suddenly after many years, you remember that, and you think, wow, what a good example that was. And you are actually inspired by those sort of things, right? You feel kind of inspired that people do such kind things in the world. So when you do something good, sometimes it has a tremendous impact on the people around you. They feel inspired. They feel uplifted that there is goodness in the world. And it's kind of these expanding rings that goes out and it affects so many people. So it is amazing how this can be such a beautiful thing to do acts of kindness, and what a tremendous effect it has for so many people in the world. So remember that, and it becomes easier to be kind. Even if you're not treated particularly well by other people, remember that's their problem. You just don't know their background. It may be very hard for them to be kind. You can still be kind in return, right? This is the idea of kindness here. So please keep that in mind. But maybe before I go on to talk a little bit more about this, because I want to talk about this in a little bit more depth, but before I do that, let me just go back to the beginning here. It starts off by saying the bhikkhu's training and way of life, right? Or the bhikkhuni's training and way of life. So what does that mean? And traditionally, these sort of statements are interpreted as keeping the Patimokkha Sila, keeping the Vinaya, you know, the big fat books which tells you how the monastic community is held together and ruled, and all the rules for the monastics. That is how often it is interpreted. But actually, it means more than that. If you interpret it in that very narrow sense, you're actually missing out on so much. The Vinaya, the rules for monastics, they are a function of the Dhamma. The Dhamma comes first. The teaching is what really matters. And then the Vinaya arises, the rules for the monastics and also the rule for the lay people arises as a consequence of the Dhamma. The Dhamma is primary, right? All these rules just come because the Buddha needs to lay something down. Because there's always a few stupid people around to do stupid things. So because of that, the Buddha needs to lay down rules. But those rules are always, they come from the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the big picture. The Dhamma is what really matters. So when it says here, the bhikkhu's training, yes, it includes the rules and all that. But really what it means, it is this kind of practice we're talking about now. The gradual training, right? This is what it really means. And included within that are, of course, the monastic rules. But the big picture is far more important. If you just live the monastic life thinking that, you know, keeping the rules that will do, it's not enough. Because you have to actually look at the training in the larger perspective. So this is what how I understand this. The word for training here is sikkha in Pali. It's the same word as sikkhapada. Sikkhapada is a training rule. So the training, and the sikkha is always means the training of an animal, of a horse, of an elephant. All of this can be called sikkha or vinaya. Even vinaya it can be called. That's why the word vinaya as well actually means training in a broader context than just rules. Sometimes it's easy to think of vinaya to mean discipline and rules, but vinaya actually means training also in a broader sense. So you undertake that, and that is what the bhikkhus or bhikkhunis training and way of life is, and also to a large extent a layperson who is practicing seriously here. Then the other thing which is interesting here, as I just mentioned, is the idea of both positive and negative immorality, right? But the other thing which is very interesting about this passage, which you may have noticed, is the idea that you abandon killing. And the abandoning of the killing is here said to be because you are compassionate, right? So the idea here is that if you are killing, you are not compassionate. But if you're not killing, you are compassionate. And this brings us back to the foundation of what ethics and morality actually means in Buddhism. It's a very important thing to understand because it broadens out the idea, the understanding of ethics. It makes us possible to take on and ask questions, modern dilemmas of ethics. How do we deal with them once we broaden this out? And this particular thing is based on the things that you see also in other suttas where the Buddha divides ethical conduct into two categories. Those actions of speech, mind and body that are based on defilements, right? Based on greed, hatred and delusion, lobha, dosa and moha in Pali. And then those actions which are not based on those, alobha, adosa, amoha, non-greed, non-hatred and non-delusion, or kindness, right? Compassion, non-desire, and clarity of mind rather than delusion. So these are the foundations for ethics. And if you're acting from one set of these things, if you're acting from the set which is not based on greed, hate and delusion, your conduct is ethical. If it is based on those things which are, you know, the defilements of the mind, the greed, hate and delusion, then your conduct is not ethical. And this is the same thing happening here. The idea here is that you are killing because of defilement. You're killing because you're not compassionate. That is what this is saying. It is putting up two sides. One side is compassion. The other side is killing. The idea is that the killing is not compassionate, whereas compassion usually includes not killing. And this broadens up broadens out the idea of morality. And of course, the classical thing that is talked about much these days in Western society and around the world these days is the idea of euthanasia, right? So where does euthanasia fall into this kind of conduct, this kind of morality? It is not clear, because on the one hand you're killing, but on the other hand you're compassionate. So which one is it? What is actually going on here? And of course the idea is that if you are, again, coming from a motivation, a root that is wholesome, it is never bad karma in Buddhism, right? And this is the idea. So if you, in an act of euthanasia, okay, the more pure you are doing that act, whether it is a person who decides for themselves that they want to die, or it is somebody helping them, in either case, the more purely you are doing that act, the more you are doing it based on compassion, the more you are doing it based on wisdom and understanding, the less bad karmic consequences there are going to be. Is it possible to do an act of euthanasia and it being good karma? Could it be good karma? It's very hard to say in any individual case, but as a general principle, yes, of course it can be. It can be good karma. If you are really coming from compassion and kindness, it can be act of good karma, because you are helping somebody else out of suffering, right? And that's what good karma is about. So, and this broadens our scope out for what morality is all about. And you can apply these ideas to all kind of dilemmas in life. Things like, you know, these days you have this IVF treatment. IVF treatment, you kind of fertilize all this large number of eggs, and then one is chosen to become an embryo in the future. The rest are often destroyed. Or you have stem cell research, right, where, again, large number of embryos are created. One or a few are chosen, the rest are destroyed. Abortion. All these kind of ethical dilemmas, which are so difficult. Is it bad or is it good? Well, first of all, you have to know your intention. Why are we doing these things? Is it because of greed? Is it because of compassion? What is the motivation behind these things? If you're ever considering an abortion, well, you need to try. Why are you doing it? Is there a good reason for having an abortion? If there is a very good reason, out of compassion for the child, for the difficult circumstances, whatever, the better the reason is, and the more pure the act you're coming from is, the less bad karma there's going to be. Of course, with abortion, it gets even more difficult. There's always the question of whether it really is a living being, right? And I think at the very early stage of a pregnancy, maybe not, right? There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that suggests it isn't. If it isn't really a living being, then there's no karma consequences. So it's a very complicated issue. But basically, the main idea here, when we talk about ethics, is know your intention, know what is driving you, know what is motivating the action. And the more pure that action is, the more pure place you're coming from, the less are going to be the ethical consequences. And don't fool yourself, right? Don't think that you're coming from purity. Don't take these kind of important decisions lightly. They're very important decisions. And it's easy to go wrong. Don't think, yeah, I'm acting morally. You know, that is not good enough. You have to be very careful. Don't make a decision if your mind is clouded. Make a decision when you have a sense of clarity inside. And then you can make these decisions, these very hard life and death situations, with a fair amount of certainty that you're doing the right thing here. So this is very controversial stuff, right? I mean, in large part of the Buddhist world, these things would probably not be accepted. And the reason is simply that there's a very strong focus on the first precept, don't kill, and there's not enough taking into account the broader ideas of the ethics and morality in Buddhism. But if you start reading the word of the Buddha like this here in more detail, you start to understand that it's actually a very flexible framework. And this is the kind of the great things about knowing the suttas in detail, understanding the Pali behind it. And it gives you this flexibility and it broadens out the scope. And I'm very grateful for having a teacher like Ajahn Brahm who allows us to have these kind of discussions and talk about these things openly. And also, Ajahn Brahm himself is a kind of person who has a very open mind about these things, right? And one of the great things about the Buddhist society, Western Australia in general, is that we try to find that line between not being too kind of traditional and bound by the ideas that are kind of out there. But on the one hand, not throwing out the Buddhist teachings, you know, throwing out the baby with the bathwater, as they say, but actually using the word of the Buddha as the basis for making decisions about what Buddhism is all about. Sometimes a difficult line to find. It's kind of a very narrow area. But that means, if you do that in the right way, it means you have a possibility of thinking about the Dhamma in new ways. And we all need to do that sometimes. Every generation of Buddhists need to think about the Dhamma in a slightly new way, because the challenges are different. Society is slightly different. That is true also for us. And to be humble enough to understand that sometimes you make a mistake. And if you make a mistake, okay, you accept that and you correct your view and you go back again. Anyway, so this is it is perhaps not so relevant for the training of the mind. The most important thing for the training of the mind is always to do good and to avoid doing bad. But it is, I think it's also useful sometimes to just broaden out the discussion a little bit. And that's what I've been trying to do with this one. Okay, so that is the first precept, the first kind of action that we need to